It's 8 o'clock. I'll call the Tax Committee to order, and we do have a quorum. And the first item of business, Representative Erickson, would you like to approve the minutes? Move the minutes, yes. You can't quite approve those quite yet.
Adoption. That's all. I adoption.
Very good. Representative Erickson moves adoption of the minutes for Wednesday, January 16th. Any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. So we're here back to continue with our overview of taxes. Yesterday we wound up talking about sales taxes, always a very simple issue. Also, members, if you, you know, there's a lot of questions on sales tax and how they apply, and, you know, it can be a difference of even how a product or something that's used can determine whether or not there's a sales tax. So if you have questions on that, feel free to talk to House Research staff about specific questions if you have any regarding sales taxes and that. So the next area, we're going to move to sales tax remote sales. And Ms. Dalton, welcome and good morning, and please proceed.
This really is an awkwardly placed microphone. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Pat Dalton with House Research, and I am picking up where we left off yesterday, which is the big question, the big issue in sales taxes, not quite as exciting as federal conformity, but from the sales tax perspective, this is kind of a watershed moment. Beginning in October 1, 2018, the state began collecting sales tax, or requiring remote sellers to collect sales tax in the state of Minnesota. To give you a little bit of background, for years, going way back to a number of court cases, Complete Auto, Bellis Hess, and Quill was the last one in 1992, the U.S. Supreme Court basically said that a state could not require a seller to collect their sales tax unless that seller actually had a physical presence in the state, otherwise known as physical presence nexus. This state, along with a number of other states, have done a lot of things over the years to try to kind of work its way around that. Things that people may have heard of are click-through nexus, where we tried to say that if you had somebody who had a click-through computer presence in the state here, then that gave you nexus. We actually had a law in our book, which ended up being very fortunate. We've had it for a very long time, that said we had a physical presence law, an economic presence law, to the extent allowed by federal law. And this ended up being vitally important for us because what happened is in June of 2018, the Supreme Court basically overturned the physical nexus provision or test and said that economic nexus was sufficient to require a remote seller to collect sales tax. Now, mind you, they also had a number of other things that they said could potentially violate Commerce Clause, but they said that the case that was decided was South Dakota versus Wayfair. And they took a look at South Dakota and they said there's a lot of things that South Dakota is doing right in terms of simplification, in terms of ease of collection. That probably means that South Dakota law does not violate Commerce Clause. It did get remanded back down to a lower court. As of right now, though, everyone's assuming the physical presence law is dead, economic presence law is in place, and as long as a state has done simplifications, you can probably collect this tax. And so we began collecting the tax here in this state October 1. Now, one of the reasons that South Dakota was viewed as being having sufficiently simplified their sales tax process was it was a member of what's called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. And this was an agreement Well, this was a project that was actually started by a number of states back in the 1990s. One of the things the Quill case had said was that Congress could overturn the physical presence standard that had been decided by the Supreme Court because Congress could regulate interstate commerce. Unfortunately, Congress never really acted, much as the states tried to get them to do it. So essentially, the states got together and decided, well, maybe what we need to do is simplify our process, and maybe then Congress will act. And if Congress doesn't act, maybe eventually we will get the Supreme Court to overturn the physical presence because of the simplification. And that seems to have actually played a fairly major factor in this. Minnesota is a member of the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. We continue to be a member of this. So we have adopted all the same simplifications of that were kind of mentioned in the dicta of the Supreme Court case in Wayfair in terms of standard definitions and other things like that. So it probably is good for us to maintain our membership in Streamlined. And as far as I know, that is the plan.
Ms. Dalton, at this time, I mean, I think it's important that we commend Ms. Dalton and past tax chairs because you've been really instrumental in working on that agreement for all of those years, and tax chairs prior have always tried to their best to, when new bills came up with sales tax and so forth, to stay under that streamlined sales and use tax agreement. And wasn't Minnesota one of kind of a few states that were able to, after the Wayfair decision, just get going right away because we had done all of this work? But congrats and commendations to you and past tax chairs for their efforts on this.
Mr. Chair, that's Collins. Correct. It is the two things. One is that we were streamlined. One, that we had this very old law that said you have a duty to collect if you have an economic presence in this state up to the amount allowed by federal law. So that allowed immediate. One of the things, Minnesota is one of the first states to actually adopt the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. We ended up kind of being a test state and ended up dealing with a lot of issues related to particularly the standard definitions. We went through a lot of angst over how do we tax bread made by bakeries and ice cream cakes and deli meats. Yeah. And so this state really did do a lot of work, particularly in the early 2000s, to not only adopt what was needed, the changes needed in our law to meet the Streamlined Agreement, but also to work with the Streamlined Agreement to identify issues that were common to states that needed some further adjustments. So this, and yes, Representative Davids went to a number of the meetings and has been supportive, as well as Representative Lincheski, and pretty much all the way down, every chair has been very adamant about let's stay in line with Streamlined.
Very good. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Ms. Dalton, for keeping this in front of us. And I remember discussions into the past, too, but and I can't remember off the top of my head. Can you remind us what the fiscal financial impact of being able to now collect tax is for our revenue? Do you have a guesstimate?
Ms. Dalton or Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg. I believe the fiscal impact is around $130 million, roughly, a year, and that is built into the MMB economic forecast.
All right, thank you.
Ms. Dalton, please continue.
At this point, I will end talking about the state tax, and I will just very, very briefly talk about local sales taxes. This is an issue that really is dealt with at the property tax system, but it has some implications for our general tax as well and Streamlined. One of the requirements of Streamlined is that there only be one agency collecting any local tax, any taxes, sales taxes in the state. So all the local taxes are actually collected by the Department of Revenue and then redistributed. There was a general prohibition against local sales and income taxes enacted in 1971. It was actually enacted as part of the Minnesota Miracle. That was a period of time where the state basically said, we're going to try to equalize local ability to fund services. But the trade-off from that is we aren't going to let local governments have all these other little taxes on the side. Needless to say, that hasn't exactly worked out over the years. I'm sorry, I've got to get to my notes because I did actually write notes. So basically, to enact a local sales tax, generally a city or county has to come in and get special legislation. And there were very few of these early on. They started to expand in the 2000s. We had a pretty large expansion in 2006 through 2008. And one of the big expansions that happened in 2008 was that we essentially allowed all counties to impose a transportation and transit local sales tax. These taxes can be imposed without voter approval. It was originally under two different statutes, one for the metro area, one for any city that was outside of the metropolitan transit area. Counties that were imposing it under the metro transit area, that transit area dissolved last year. And so now all of these counties are actually imposing the transportation tax under the general law that was originally enacted for greater Minnesota. As of January 1, 2019, 41 out of the 87 counties imposed a transportation sales tax. I just got a notice from the Department of Revenue that two more will be imposing one starting April 1, 2019. The 41 counties that were imposing it as of January represent well over three-fourths of the population in this state. So the vast majority of people in this state now live in a county that imposes a quarter cent or a half cent local sales tax. And what was I going to say about that? Which basically implies, or you can take away from that, that the counties that don't tend to be the smaller and poorer counties that do not have a major retail base.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the I'm interested in the rationale behind why, counties or local municipalities are allowed to, or I guess counties in particular, are allowed to impose sales tax but not income tax when, like, you know, as we just went through this kind of overview, it's like this much more regressive tax that impacts low-income people, more potently. And so like, if we put in a prohibition on both of those things in 1971, like, why did we let the more regressive taxation authority move forward and not the one that actually is more fair?
Ms. Dalton. And that is probably more of a legislative policy question, certainly.
But Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree. It's definitely more of a policy question, but some of the problems with imposing an income tax at the local level is, do you impose an income tax on the people who reside in the jurisdiction, or do you impose an income tax on the people who earn income in that jurisdiction? That gets to be very tricky. And of course, there are bedroom communities who would love to impose a tax on where people live, whereas if you have a lot of industry, you want to impose a tax on where people work. But the other issues is then it starts leading to a lot more of the economic competition. And this state has done a lot to kind of mitigate the incentives local governments have to fight with each other over development. That's one of the reasons we have fiscal disparities programs. So there isn't this big, I need all the commercial development here in my city. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, we're poor relative to other people. We do a lot of equalization in this state, and that has been one of the trade-offs. And that was actually one of the trade-offs in 1971, is most states have realized that you can either equalize ability to fund services at the local level, or you can provide lots of flexibility and individual choices at the local level. But they get very hard to do both of them simultaneously. And that's actually one of the issues that we have going on with local sales taxes. One of the things that local sales taxes generally have to prove when they come in, or at least legislators have asked them to make the case, is that local sales taxes generally are used only for brick and mortar projects that have regional significance. Now, regional significance is in the eye of the beholder, and sometimes it has been interpreted more broadly than other times, but that is one of the things, is that they say, we're only doing sales tax if there is a reason that it should be, the payment of this project should extend beyond just the city limits, because you're either serving the population around, or because it's a tourist-based project and the sales tax is at least partially based by the people coming in for tourist purposes into your city or county.
Thank you.
Local sales taxes, 31 of them have been imposed as of January 1, 2019. 2017 saw an increase in the number of them, including our very first non-county, non-city local sales tax. We have a sanitary sewer district up near Mille Lacs that now actually has a sales tax. And again, you know, talking about why these have been allowed, that one was because this was a district that has major implications on the health of the lake and which is a major tourist destination. And at that, I will, unless there are other questions, I will stop, and we will move on to corporate taxes.
Thank you very much. Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I will just cover quickly a brief overview of the revenues for corporate tax and the tax incident slides. So on page 42 of your handout, you can see there is a 10-year history of corporate tax revenues from fiscal 2009 to fiscal 2019. And in fiscal 2009, you can see in nominal dollars are not labeled here, but about $700 million was collected. Nominal dollars are the kind of the hashed lines. And in 2019, $1.3 billion was collected, or is projected to be collected in fiscal 19 for corporate taxes. I am going to kind of cover slide 47 because I think that got out of place. That slide, let's see, where is it? That slide is provides just kind of the big picture. Again, $1.3 billion is projected to be collected in corporate taxes. And I have a correction to this slide, too. As you know, corporate taxes is one of the more volatile taxes, and you can see that in slide 42. But on slide 47, jumping back and forth, there is a note that shows that $1.17 million was collected in fiscal 2007. That should be $1.17 billion. Someone would have caught that, I think, eventually. So that is a quick overview of the revenues of corporate taxes. Now, going back to slide 43, we have, again, a tax incident slide that shows the effective tax rates for corporate taxes, and that is the ratio of corporate taxes paid by quintile relative to household income.
And as you can see, corporate taxes like sales taxes is a regressive tax. You can see that in the quintiles, the with the lowest income, the first quintile has a 1% effective tax rate, which is the highest rate relative to the other quintiles. Slide 44 shows who pays the corporate tax, and again, this shows the ratio of corporate taxes paid for each quintile relative to total corporate taxes. And again, the fifth quintile, which is the quintile with the highest income, pays the largest share of the tax. One thing to note in this slide is that the kind of the distribution is a little more equal relative to the other taxes on who pays. So that is it with the tax incident slide, and my colleague Mr. Clayman will cover the rest.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, Chris Clayman with House Research. Just have a few more slides here on the corporate franchise tax. I guess the first thing to note about the corporate franchise tax is this tax is only imposed on C corporations, so these are typically the very large publicly traded corporations. Other businesses who are organized as, say, a partnership, an LLC, or an S corp, they'll pay the individual income tax as that income is passed through to the individual on their individual income tax return. Ms. Dalton actually referenced the Complete Auto case. I don't know if anyone caught it, but that's a pretty significant case in the tax area for imposing constitutional limitations on the ability of states to impose state taxes. One of the other requirements from that case is that a state tax has to be fairly apportioned, which is to say that when it comes to the corporate franchise tax, the state of Minnesota can only tax what is essentially its fair share of a multi-state or even multinational corporation. So the state has to figure out a way to fairly apportion the Minnesota portion of that income to the state. And the way that this state is doing that, has decided to do this, is through what's called single sales factor apportionment, which is without getting too far into the details, essentially what we do is we look at the percentage of sales in Minnesota by a corporation relative to total sales of that corporation. We take that percentage and we say we're going to take that percentage of a corporation's income under our apportionment formula. The idea behind single sales factor apportionment, there are other ways to apportion, and this state up until 2014 actually included the amount of payroll and the amount of property in the apportionment formula. What that does is it ends up weighting other factors than sales more heavily when you determine that percentage of how much income of a corporation the state's going to sort of allocate to itself or apportion to itself. That has the effect of disadvantaging corporations that are headquartered in Minnesota who have a lot of, you know, warehouses or payroll or facilities in Minnesota. So the trend back in, I can't remember the exact date, but starting in 2014, we went to single sales factor, and that's been the trend around the country as time goes on because of the it can put local or in-state corporations on an equal footing to out-of-state corporations because of the weighting. The tax rate for the corporate franchise tax is 9.8%.
Mr. Clayman, we have a question. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate that. Yesterday on slide number 8, if you want to look, we talked about effective tax rates, and we talked about households, and we're talking about C-corps here, but where do S-corps, you know, the pass through? Would that be considered household income, you know, for those businesses? And then I have one follow-up.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I mean, for purposes of thinking about this in the context of income taxes, yes. So, you know, S-corps would essentially pay their business tax through the individual income tax system.
So,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, so I just want people to be aware of that household income for some of these S-corps is kind of different, but I'm trying to understand that. I do have a question, though, pertaining to the franchise tax and then the sales outside of the state. How is that? Is there any factor for that for S-Corps?
Mr. Kleeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, no. So the S-Corps wouldn't be, they're not taxed under the corporate franchise tax. So if that answers your
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I'll have some follow-up later. I want some more clarity on how some of our S-Corps do business. You know, they do a small percentage of business in Minnesota, but 90% outside of Minnesota, and they're taxed, and I'm sure I'll figure that out someday.
Okay.
Maybe next year.
Mr. Clayman.
Yeah,
thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm happy to follow up with you offline about that, too. Moving on to the...
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be another question everybody laughs at, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So can you just tell me about the, like, kind of policy decision about, you identified that these, the corporate tax rate is relatively regressive. Can you tell me about what the kind of policy justification is for more regressive rather than progressive rates on corporations?
Mr. Clayman, so as much as you maybe can on the technical part, you don't have to get into the policy of what we decide, but whatever you can answer on that.
I guess just I could talk a little bit about the incidence of the tax. The 2017 tax incidence report, and the Department of Revenue will come out with their 2019 tax incidence report this year. They mentioned that the incidence of the corporate franchise tax falls on not just shareholders. There's a big chunk that falls on shareholders. It also falls on consumers and also on labor. So a portion of that falls on labor in the form of lower wages. So I think that explains to some extent the regressivity that you're seeing in the corporate franchise tax.
And so, Representative Gomez, when we talk about a progressive or regressive tax system, that's very much a policy. A lot of those things in the mix of taxes that you go. So, but as Mr. Clayman says, when they look at the tax incident, a lot of times when we tax businesses, we think it's only the business being taxed, but the consumer and labor is also being taxed besides the shareholders and the business owners. We will spend some time with the incident report when it comes out, and I think I heard that might be in March. If I thought someone mentioned that yesterday, and we'll spend some time with that because it is a very interesting report. So, Representative Gomez, anything else?
Oh no, I just appreciate even that bit of perspective. I just was kind of asking like what the general justification was, not to put you in a weird position where I'm asking for like policy advice. So I appreciate the help. Thanks.
Representative Lesh.
Well, I just, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to point out in light of what was stated, there's kind of been this boogeyman floating around for a few years by Democrats and Republicans that corporations don't pay taxes because they just pass them on to consumers. Is that right? Did I get it right? Okay, good. Well, if that's the case, then consumers also pass on the costs to demanding higher wages to those same corporations. So this isn't a closed system in a one-way street here where corporations can come up to the testifying table and say, please, please don't raise our taxes. Oh, and by the way, we don't pay them anyway. We just pass them on. We're all a part of this system. And I think we need to make sure that we're aware of that we're not just saying, okay, because there's been discussion about doing away with the corporate franchise tax because of that sort of myth that corporations don't pay them, even though they're the only ones up here saying, please don't tax us. So I just wanted to point that out, Mr. Chair, that it does, in fact, cut both ways on this, not just a one-way street.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick reminder, just to remind myself, the choice for a business to set up an LLC or an S-Corp or a C-Corp is definitely just a choice, right? There's no minimum amount of income or size of business that you have to be a C-Corp.
Mr. Clayman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, typically you've got the choice to determine, you know, how you want to organize your business and your business entity. I guess I'm not familiar enough with the law of business entity formation to give you a distinct and clear answer on that. I don't want to say something that's not correct, but I can certainly check on that and get back to you later.
Thank
but
you.
Certainly when it comes to, say, like, do you want to be a partnership, an S-Corp, an LLC, you can choose whatever you want. So,
Representative Joaquin.
So follow up. So it is a choice, and then each of them has different tax implications.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, the biggest tax implication would be the difference between being taxed as a C corporation versus being taxed under one of the other pass-through business entity forms. So the S corp, the partnership, the LLC. The business income of a pass-through, so sole proprietorship would be another one, is taxed under the individual income tax. So, and there's a, I guess, one of the reasons why pass-throughs exist is to avoid the double taxation issue that happens with C-Corps. So the entity, of the corporate entity is taxed under the corporate franchise tax. And then to the extent that entity, say through dividends, passes income to shareholders on an after-tax basis, then those shareholders would also pay income tax on what they receive in income from the corporation. A pass-through entity avoids that double taxation issue because the income passes directly through to the owner without being taxed at the entity level. So say a partnership doesn't have too many taxes that are imposed on the actual partnership entity. Instead, that individual owner of a pass-through just pays the individual income tax on that business income that they earn. And so in the case of, say, like an S-Corp that we were talking about earlier, that S-Corp will pay, the individual who's the owner of the S-Corp will pay individual income sales tax based on their income, no matter where it's earned. Whereas the C-Corp, you have these two other layers of taxation.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that there was that choice or option there.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the group, let's say you have a dollar of corporate income. Because you have the double rate of a taxation, how much on average would it be effective tax rate, not of each individual, but then if you add those two taxes as a layered, so the profits of the corporation taxed at the corporate rate, franchise tax, and then as that dollar moves into the dividend holder, so the people that actually own part of that business, and then on the individual rate, what is the rate, if you took both those and stacked them together, for that income? Yeah, it depends on where they're at.
Mr. Clayton.
Looking at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski, I don't have any, number. I don't have any information on that in front of me here. I don't know if Ms. Templin has a read on that.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski, I think the question is, if you had a dollar, what would be the effective rate? And again, it would depend on the quintiles. But I mean, the effective rates for the fifth quintile for income taxes is 5.9%, and for corporate taxes for the fifth quintile, the effective tax rate is 0.3%. So, to the extent that that provides some guidance.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swedzinski, I mean, one other, point to raise in this regard on double taxation is that there have been some studies that have looked at, who the actual shareholders are of a lot of the C-Corps, and some of those shareholders are themselves exempt entities, so they're exempt from the income tax. So if that's the case, then you don't necessarily have a double taxation issue if the ultimate shareholder is not taxed. So that's just another kind of piece to this whole puzzle. But.
Okay, please proceed.
Okay, I guess a few other notes to make about the corporate franchise tax. We do allow tax credits for the corporate franchise tax. The beginning farmer credit that was passed a couple years ago. A corporation can take the beginning farmer, or the sales to beginning farmers piece of that credit. That's available to C-Corps. And we have more information on those corporate tax credits in the income overview document that's included in your packets if you wanted more information on that. We also have a minimum fee, which applies to all businesses, not just C-Corps. And that's also nestled within those corporate tax provisions in Chapter 290. And that those fees are indexed for inflation as well. So, Mr. Chair, I'll turn this over to Ms. Templin.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, I'll cover the tax incident slides again. Alex comes to the table. Slide 48 of your presentation, you see the effective tax rates for excise taxes, specifically fuels taxes, cigarette taxes, and liquor taxes. They're combined in this slide. And again, effective taxes is the ratio of excise taxes paid relative to household income. And you can see, like sales taxes and corporate taxes, excise taxes are very regressive. The quintile with the lowest income pays 3.4% as an effective tax rate for these taxes. And again, these taxes are regressive. I will, moving on to the next slide. You can see who pays these taxes. Again, the fifth quintile, the quintile with the highest income, pays the largest share at 28.8%. One thing to note, again, this the distribution among the quintiles, it's a there's less disparity in the distribution. They're a little more equal in the excise taxes in terms of the share of the burden of who pays. And that is it.
Okay. Ms. Hagler, welcome.
Hi. Good morning. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, my name is Alex Hagler. I'm the new analyst in House Research in the tax group, and I'm new as of November, so go easy on me. I'm going to talk about a few of the excise taxes, starting with the motor vehicle fuels tax.
Ms. Hagler, just a second. Representative Becker Finn, you had a question before we got going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted, also for the public's benefit, as we're looking at all these different quintiles, could you just clarify on whether that's adjusted gross income, Minnesota taxable income, gross income, the numbers on each of these charts where we're showing those?
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, the household income is household income, and it's defined in the tax incidence report. And there's a fair on page 91 specifically, and there's a fairly
right in front of me.
Yeah, if you have the report, yes, there's a fairly long table that defines what's household income, and it includes wages, taxable interest and dividends, business income, capital gains, and so on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hagler.
Okay, so the motor vehicle fuels tax, there are actually three main types of taxes there. There's the gas tax, the special fuels tax, and the aviation tax. And the gas tax is the most probably popular one, which is imposed on all motor fuel used by vehicles on public highways and marine gasoline as well. The rates are there right on the slide at 25 cents per gallon, and there's also an additional debt service surcharge of 3.5 cents on each gallon. So the total then comes to about 28.5 cents per gallon.
The Representative Lesh, before you head on here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that motor vehicle fuels tax, am I right that is not included in the excise taxes? Because the excise taxes are levied on these manufactured goods at the point of manufacture, not at the sale. Is that right? Or did you include this in the excise taxes list?
So, Representative Lesher, you're referring to slide number 48?
Yes.
So, Ms. Templin, where you have the effective rates are the fuel taxes included? Looks like it is. Fuel, cigarette, and liquor, but are we talking about, but we know, say, the gas tax, is that included in on that?
That's correct, yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the fuels tax is included. It comes from a table in the tax incidence report, table 2.2, and it is included.
Okay, so
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Templin, just to be clear, I had understood that an excise tax was levied at the moment of manufacture, and so it wouldn't be the gas tax that we pay when we buy it. Or is that just, in my misunderstanding, is that just part of the price, and we pay it at the moment that we buy it just because we see it there on the tank? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm going to ask Ms. Dalton. She might have something to add on this, if I can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, you should actually think of an excise tax as the same thing as a sales tax. It's just that it's paid at a different level than the final retail sale. It's either paid at the wholesale level or it is paid at the manufacturing level. But it's paid further up the stream and then gets incorporated into the price.
Okay, so
Representative Lesh.
So, Mr. Chair, so the gas tax that we pay, we don't actually pay at the point of sale then. Is that right? Because it's an excise tax?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, that's correct. It has been paid at a higher level.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
And then incorporated into the price.
Got it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gomez.
But, like, for a consumer, what's the substantive difference between an excise tax and a sales tax?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, it basically is who is legally responsible for remitting, for paying that tax and remitting it. For instance, in a sales tax, even though the retailer is responsible for remitting it, the retailer has legal ability to go back and get it from their customer if it wasn't collected at the time of the sale. Yes, I know. That has probably shocked you. It doesn't happen often, but it does sometimes happen, particularly in sales to businesses. As I said, businesses often pay sales tax. So the legal obligation to pay the tax is actually on the consumer, but the legal obligation to collect and remit the tax is on the retailer in this state. If you don't pay the sales tax in this state at the retail level, you are legally obligated to pay the complementary use tax instead. So back when remote sellers weren't collecting our sales tax, you were legally obligated to pay the use tax. Nobody, or very few people did, but it was actually on the books. For these excise taxes, the legal obligation to pay the tax and remit the tax all fall on a higher level. Doesn't mean they can't pass the tax on. So you're right. In practical terms, the consumer is still paying the tax, but they aren't seeing it. They aren't legally liable if the person further upstream didn't pay the tax.
Representative Gomez.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalton, thank you so much for this. So why are there excise taxes and sales taxes then, I guess?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, mainly it's an administrative issue. Where is the tax easiest to collect? And so there are taxes that are easier to collect, and we'll get into this with some of the liquor taxes and things like that. You know, because you have to be licensed to sell liquor in this state, it is much easier to collect tax from the liquor wholesalers than it is from everybody making sure that everybody paid on their six-pack of beer as they walked out of the liquor store.
Oh, thank you. We learn something every day. This is very good. So, Ms. Hagler.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton. So moving on, the other two types of fuel tax, there's the special fuel tax, which is imposed on propane and liquid or condensed natural gas, and that's used by licensed motor vehicles only. And then the aviation tax is just aviation gas and jet fuel. There are a few
items that are exempt from this. For example, public transit is exempt from the gas tax, and certain providers of medical and ambulatory services. The revenues from the tax are constitutionally dedicated to the Highway User Trust Fund, and local governments receive a share of the revenue from the fund under the Municipal and County State Aid Street Fund. And there you can see in fiscal 19 was projected to be about $925.3 million in revenue. Thank you. Okay, the cigarette and tobacco tax, they're imposed a little bit differently based on the type of tobacco. So for cigarettes, it's imposed on a per unit basis, which is the number of cigarettes sold, not as a percentage of the sale price. Cigarettes also have an additional tax imposed on each pack, and that is where the stamp from the Department of Revenue comes in. And the commissioner sets that rate every year. And for 2019, that rate is set at 55.8 cents per pack. For other tobacco products, such as cigars, pipe, and chewing tobacco, a 95% of the... So for those other tobacco products, a 95% of the wholesale price is imposed at the distributor level. Thank you. So here you can also see in fiscal 19, it was projected about $224 million, and about $26 million of that is dedicated to health research. And the 50 cents per pack fee applies to non-settlement cigarettes, which I believe has something to do with some court cases a while back, and that's about $6.5 million of the revenue. The alcoholic...
Ms. Hagler, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hagler, in regards to the cigarette tax, with the Juul and the vaping being so popular amongst many, unfortunately, even the youth, are those projections in this diagram? And if not, is there any fiscal impact on those Juul tax? I presume we tax the vaping and products and the liquid as well.
Ms. Hagler?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I believe they were included in those projections.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. It's included in the cigarette and tobacco tax total in the $624 million. Specifically, how much of that revenue is from vaping? I haven't seen recent estimates, but I can try to go back and get that information for you and get back to you on that.
Thank you. Ms. Hagler.
So for the alcoholic beverage excise tax, there is a special excise tax and a gross receipts tax. And the special tax is imposed on the manufacturer or the wholesaler. And the rates are at a fixed amount per barrel or per liter. And those are shown here on the slide based on the type of alcohol you're talking about. And the gross receipts tax will just be explained in a moment. The tax is generally unrelated to the alcoholic content or the price, although some higher rates do apply to certain wines that are a little bit higher in alcohol. And it was projected $93.1 million for fiscal 19. And so the revenues will grow as more liters of barrels are sold, not when the price increases. So the gross receipts tax, it functions more like a retail sale on both the on-site and off-site sale of liquor. So the 2.5% tax applies to retailers on making on and off sales. The on sales are consumption on the premises, so if you're at a bar or a restaurant, whereas the off sale are some, if you just go to a liquor store and consume at home or wherever. So that was projected at $95 million in fiscal 19.
Thank
And then on slides 58, we get back to the tax incident slides again. And this is looking at other state taxes. And other state taxes, I just wanted to make a note, includes solid waste management taxes, mortgage and deed taxes, insurance taxes, Minnesota care taxes, and motor vehicle registration taxes. So the sum of all these taxes and the effective tax rates, again, you can see like sales taxes and corporate taxes, these taxes are also regressive, where households with the lowest income are paying the largest share of their household income on these taxes. It's roughly about 2.2% for the effective tax rate. And you can see there is it's also broken down by consumer and business shares. On slide 58, this is the final tax incident slide. It shows again who pays the tax. And again, the fifth quintile, the quintile with the highest income pays the largest share at 45.4%.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am going to just very briefly talk about motor vehicle license taxes. These are one of the other taxes. They're generally not dealt with in this committee. They are kind of in the purview of the Transportation Committee because the revenues from it are constitutionally dedicated for transportation purposes. The tax is based on a base value of the passenger vehicle, and a base value basically, there's one level that's without all the bells and whistles, and so that's really what your tax is. You don't pay a motor vehicle registration tax on your heated seats and your sunroof and things like that. So the tax rate is 1.25% of the base value, and then it reduces as the vehicles age. And there's a statutory depreciation schedule, which if you ask me about it, I'm not going to be able to tell you. But however, when a vehicle hits 10 years old, then it pretty much is just at a $35 a year registration tax. As I said, the revenues are dedicated to highway users. You can dedicated highway user trust fund. It raises about $800 million, and about 40% of that goes to the local governments under county and municipal street aid funds.
Thank you. We have a question. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, you had said the motor vehicle tax is primarily handled in the Transportation Committee. Is that also the gas tax?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, I believe that is actually part, I'm going to look at Cynthia, I believe that is part of their accounts. We only get involved in it if it starts to impact some of the taxes under your purview, such as sales tax and things like that.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question, then looking ahead to the next slide with the Minnesota care taxes. Is that the same with the provider tax? Is that our purview, or is that going to be under HHS?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Clayman.
Representative Lean, I think Ms. Templin may have an answer for that. I just to fill some dead air here while she was getting up to the
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. The provider tax, that is a revenue that goes into the Healthcare Access Fund, and these revenues are an expenditure. Those revenues are an expenditure in the healthcare or in the Human Services Committee. Typically, the provider tax is an important piece of their the Human Services Committee. So that, to the extent that tax is under their jurisdiction, but it is also a tax. And often, I know, like going back to the gas tax, that committee often makes the policy decisions with the tax, and sometimes those taxes are carried in tax bills in the end, but not all the time. But the tax committee always has discussions about, you know, taxes and other committees. So it's kind of yes and no.
Representative Lean, to both the gas tax and the provider tax, if there's any further debate at all this session on those items, if it occurs. will this committee will be very much involved in those issues.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, well, continuing on with the Minnesota care taxes, this is also the tax that's commonly referred to as the provider tax. This is a tax that's imposed on hospitals, healthcare providers, and wholesale drug distributors. It's a gross receipts tax, so it's based on total gross receipts. The rate is 2%. There are some exemptions under the provider tax for, you know, revenues received from Medicare or medical assistance. I guess the also nursing homes, home health care services are also exempt from that tax. You know, one of the main features of this tax is that it's going to sunset at the end of this year. So 2019 will be the last year that the provider tax is in effect without further legislative action, of course. So moving on to the insurance premium tax, the key thing to recognize.
Clayman, hold on just a second. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. excuse me. When you live in border areas like Chair Marquardt and I do, a lot of people go across the river into North Dakota for their health care. I'm assuming that Minnesota residents that go to Grand Forks or Fargo, when they get their treatments there, do not pay that provider tax. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that is correct. And that would not be allowable under federal law either, constitutional law.
Mr. Clayman.
So the insurance premium tax, one of the key features with the insurance premium tax to keep in mind is that insurance companies do not pay the corporate franchise tax. They pay the insurance premium tax. This is a tax that's based on gross premiums, somewhat similar to the gross receipts tax, except in the insurance world. The tax rate is 2%, although there are different rates for other types of insurers. Another interesting feature of this tax, this is one of the only taxes that federal law actually allows the United States to tax in a discriminatory way with respect to out-of-state insurance companies, typically under the Commerce Clause. Again, we could go back to the complete auto case again, but you cannot discriminate against out-of-state commerce under the Dormant Commerce Clause, and that applies to the tax area as well through that case. There's an exception for insurance premium taxes, so we actually have a retaliatory tax in out-of-state insurance companies in Minnesota, and that tax is the higher of the rate that the home state of the out-of-state insurance company imposes on a Minnesota insurance company or the Minnesota insurance premium tax rate. So they're doing bad things to our companies, we're going to do bad things to their companies. And we can do that under the Constitution. It's sort of a quirk of federal law.
Speaking on that, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to have us members ask questions throughout the program here. Based on that, then, if we were to open up in Minnesota to allow outside insurance companies to do business in health care, and we only have, what, four or five that are allowed to do business in our state, if we allowed them to cross state lines, not only would that reduce health care premiums for families, but also it would increase revenues to the state of Minnesota because of this tax. Is that correct?
Mr. Clayman.
I'll just sort of take the latter part of that question. To the extent that an out-of-state insurance company is headquartered in a state that places a higher tax rate on a Minnesota company in that state than our insurance tax rate would be placed on their company, then that would be, it could potentially be the case. There's maybe some behavioral effects too to think about there, but I mean, that's not a bad way to look at it, I guess.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for those who are on the Health and Human Services committees and those who probably are aware that would create more revenue for the state and lower the health care premiums for Minnesotans, so that's good advice to hear and to pass forward in the HHS. Looking forward to help lower the premiums for our health care.
Representative McDonald, yesterday you said you wanted nothing to do with Health and Human Services. And now you're starting to talk policy on Health and Human Services and Tax Committee. That just cannot happen. Thank you. Mr. Klayman.
Sure. Also, portions of the insurance premiums tax are dedicated to Minnesota Care, also police and fire pension aid, which I guess taking after my colleague, Ms. Dalton, which I don't know much about, so I couldn't tell you more about that if you asked me about the police and fire aid pension. I did neglect to note that the revenues under the Minnesota Care taxes are also dedicated to help fund Minnesota Care and medical assistance programs. That was in the slide, but that's also, of course, another key feature of that program. So I think we'll move on to the estate tax.
Representative,
oh, I'm sorry.
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What portion, or what are the total dollars that go to the Minnesota Care tax that go into that fund that comes from, I'm sorry, I missed that. Oh, $692 million, is that how much goes in there from this tax that goes into the Minnesota Care Fund?
I believe that's the amount that goes into the Health Care Access Fund. It's 100%, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian.
Okay, estate tax.
The estate tax, we have a standalone estate tax in the state. I guess I'll do a little history here. It's on the slide. Prior to 2001, for every dollar in state estate tax that you paid, your federal estate tax liability would go down. So you could sort of think about that like a credit. That ended in 2001. We now have a standalone tax, which is now, which is deductible though in computing your federal estate taxes. The estate tax is based on the value of your estate, but there are some exclusions from the value of your estate that you can take, or that the estate can take to get the value down, sort of like a deduction on the personal income side. I guess two of the big exemptions that we have under the estate tax are the exclusion amount, which was changed in 2017 by the legislature, that sort of changed in a stepwise fashion, so it's a little tough to kind of exactly say what it changed from to what it changed to, but effectively the ultimate exclusion amount was increased from $2 million to $3 million. That $3 million exclusion amount for the estate will be effective in 2020, and for decedents dying in 2019, the exclusion is $2.7 million. You can pair that exclusion with the qualified small business and farm property exemption under the estate tax. And that exemption allows people to, it's sort of like taking an extra amount of the exclusion if you devise property to, or farm property or business property to an heir, and they continue to use that property for 3 years in the way that it had been. The total amount between the qualified farm property subtraction and small business, or qualified farm property exemption and small business exemption, combined with the other exclusion, cannot exceed $5 million. So as we're sort of stepping up to $3 million, the amount of those qualified farm property and business exemptions are all stepping down. So when we hit $3 million on the exclusion, it'll be $2 million for the other two.
Representative Gomez.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say that it's deductible, the Minnesota state tax is deductible in computing federal estate tax, that means what it sounds like the amount, or, yeah, I guess could you just explain it?
Sure. So, when you pay when the federal estate tax is paid, they can deduct from the value of the federal estate the amount paid in estate taxes, but that would be, the benefit of that would be equal to, it wouldn't be dollar for dollar, the benefit of that would be equal to the federal estate tax rate times the deduction for the state tax, so the amount of state tax paid.
Representative Gomez?
I mean, you kind of lost me, but we can talk about it more later.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. passed down exemptions for qualified small business and farm properties. Maximum was 2.6. I thought maximum was like 5.4. Conditions if it stays in the family and is operated for 3 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, so the total maximum amount is $5 million between the exemption and the exclusion, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, it says $2.6
million. Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Davids. I think maybe we need to update. I think we need to update something here.
And you really should wait until 2020, Mr. Chairman.
Right, right.
I think it's 2018. It's the exception.
Oh, that's
2.4, and so in 2018 right. It would be 2.6. That would equal the 5. Is that
right, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, Representative Davids.
That's off 2018 numbers. Right. Then the 2020 is the 3 and the 2. Mr. Clayman.
Yeah. Sorry, I got temporarily confused. So yeah, it would be 2.4 million for 18 for the exclusion, and then the qualified farm property and business subtraction would be 2.6 for 2018. So sorry for the confusion there. Yeah.
I think very good, Mr. Clayman.
Sure. And then the rates range from 13% to 16% beginning in 2018. Those were also changed because of some administrative changes that happened to the estate tax. The estate tax, this is another very volatile tax. We saw a slide on the corporate franchise tax. That's also a volatile tax. The estate tax is also volatile because the amount that the state collects in revenues from the estate tax really depends on, you know, how wealthy a decedent was in a particular year that that decedent dies. So, for instance, in 2001, it was $54 million. 2006, it was $216 million. 33 states don't have an estate or an inheritance tax. Minnesota is one of the states that does. I guess skipping down to the bottom bullet, the estate tax is progressive. It's got a suits index of 0.84. That's a figure that you'll see on the tax incidence study when it comes out. The below one is progressive, and above one is regressive. I guess, and then going on to that, the other bullet about that we have up there about the effect on domicile decisions. Under the estate tax, we tax decedents who were residents at the time they've died and also tangible personal property that's usually kept in Minnesota, say for a non-resident. So, the question often comes up. So in other words, the question of residency when it comes to the estate tax affects primarily the taxation of those intangibles, so stocks, bonds, bank accounts, those types of intangible types of personal property. And so the question, comes up often, is there an effect on domicile or residency determinations by people due to the estate tax? So,
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Clayman, you might not have this handy, but I seem to recall, and I think it's useful to know, that it's a really tiny percentage of our population that pays this. I know when we talked about increasing the amounts, there was a discussion of like 1,100 people, but I don't remember what the base was of how many estates a year typically have to pay this. Do you have any information on that?
Mr. Clayman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yeah, we don't have that information with us today, but we could put our heads together and see if we can find that for you.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also just wondering if I would assume that, like, when the exemption amount was raised, whenever that decision was made, that there was, like, a projection of what the fiscal impact of that would be, and I was just wondering if you guys could share that with me, like what's the impact going to be of raising that exemption from 2.4 to 3 million in 2020?
I, Representative Gomez, I do know at the time, of course, there's a revenue estimate. I don't know if staff would have that right now, but it'd be easy to look back at what that would be. So I don't know. Ms. Templin, do you have that right now from the 2017 tax bill, I believe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, just 1 minute and I'll look it up in the spreadsheet.
Okay. You want to go continue on the mortgage registry tax? Any more questions on the estate tax? Ms. Hagler, are you doing that one? Okay. Well, Ms. Templin's looking that up, if you would continue with the mortgage registry tax.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex Hagler.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have one more. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. I just have to say, based on Representative Loeffler's suggestion or mention that it's a small portion, 4 years ago, a family farm in Howard Lake, I won't mention the name, approached me at the local grain elevator when I was doing business there, said that because of the estate tax, they had to sell the family farm because they simply couldn't afford it, and it's been in the family for close to 100 years. I had not the heart to tell her, but it's a small percentage at the time. But it's real life situations and scenarios that caused, because of that death tax, caused a family in my district to have to sell the family farm after close to 100 years. So small percentage, but boy, it's a huge impact.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you don't want us to get into a debate on things, but I think when we get to discussing this further, I remember Representative Schultz had data about how within Minnesota and nationwide, it's very much the exception that any farm has ever had to be sold to pay estate taxes. It's usually the heirs don't want to run the tax, run the farm, and it's, they'd rather sell to get the resources, and they use the estate tax to explain to neighbors, but it may not be the reality.
And following the tradition of past tax chairs, whenever another member's name is mentioned, they always have a chance to respond. So, Ms. Templin, did we find anything yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, the question was what was the revenue impact of the increased phase-in that was enacted in 2017? The tracking sheet shows for 2017 that the estimated revenue loss is $34.8 million in the fiscal 2018 and 2019 biennium, and the estimated revenue loss for the 2020 and 2021 biennium is $74.5 million.
Ms. Templin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, continuing on to the mortgage registry tax, this is often thought of in conjunction with the deed tax because when you buy a property, the transactions are so intertwined here. So the mortgage tax is imposed when the mortgage is recorded, and it's imposed on 0.23% of the principal debt that the mortgage is taking on, and it's paid by the borrower to the lender, who then remits it to the county, and the county treasurer then remits 97% of it to the state and keeps 3% for administrative expenses. And then in fiscal 2019, it was estimated $114.9 million, and collection of this is obviously dependent on the housing market. So the deed transfer tax is imposed when a deed is transferred, and it's imposed on the value of the property when it is transferred, and it's 0.33% of the price paid. The seller is liable but is often paid by the buyer when the deed is recorded, and again, that's a paid to the treasurer, who then remits 97% to the state, and it was estimated $143 million incoming.
Representative Wyszynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so for the mortgage registry tax, would that be when there's a general lien? So if there's a mortgage on it, would it like a, I'm thinking like a contract for deed? Though this is a little in the weeds a bit, but are those collected at both the same time, and only if there's a lien against the property? So if you're paying cash for a house, this tax is not collected. So if you're just writing a check to whomever that might be, that's not collected. And then from the deed transfer tax, that would be under all transactions.
Ms. Hagler?
If you need to email me that answer, that's fine, too. I know that's a little bit.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, I'll let Chris take this question.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Klayman, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, I believe that for a contract for deed, you wouldn't pay the deed tax until the deed is actually transferred at the fulfillment of the contract. As far as the mortgage registry tax goes, I think the second part of your question, the mortgage registry tax is paid whenever there is, well, mortgage registry tax would be paid when that mortgage is recorded. So it could be a refinance or a purchase mortgage. And then the deed tax, of course, is paid on the transfer of the deed. So,
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a mortgage registry tax could be paid multiple times within the ownership of a single home. So if, let's say you, every 7 years, you do a you get a new percentage of lien against it. That essentially, every single time, that would be re-recorded. So when you refinance every time, that's going to be paid.
Mr. Klayman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, yes, I believe that's correct. And some states have actually created particular types, like New York has a particular type of loan where you can actually do a sort of a quote-unquote refinance that doesn't actually involve actually recording another mortgage, and that's to avoid some of the taxes that apply in that state. They're called CEMA mortgages.
Just one last. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to Mr. Klayman, so essentially this would be considered a little bit. I mean, we have a statewide business property tax for businesses. But so, from a housing standpoint, this would be kind of the statewide business property tax in a housing particular area.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, I mean, from a very sort of, general standpoint, in the sense that, the state is imposing a tax on transfers of real property, whereas the state general tax applies to commercial industrial real property. Mm-hmm. Statewide, but it's not a levy on real property. It's the tax base is different, but
yeah, it's on the whatever the percentage of lien.
Right, correct. Yeah,
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Clems. This is different than the MPI when you put the 20% down and you don't have to pay the interest. It's separate.
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, you're talking about mortgage insurance premium. Yeah, this would be different than than that. Yep.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as long as you have Mr. Klayman out there, I'd like to just go back to the estate tax for a second, because I got to figure out how to do this. Let's just say I owned a lot of land, a lot of real estate, and let's say I had a lot of money. Just hypothetically. And so I've got land and I got a lot of money. Loaded. Boatloads. Okay. So I go to a state, my change of residency, you got it up there, to go to a state that has no estate tax. Okay. But you mentioned something about all my land would still be taxed in Minnesota, even though I'm not a resident of Minnesota anymore, so all my cash is over in the other state. That's easy to do. Mm-hmm. Okay. How am I taxed on my massive holding of land?
Mr. Klayman, and by the way, where does boatloads of money fall in the decile range? I'd like to know exactly. If there's a definition of boatloads.
It's the David's decile.
Okay, I see. Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, if you're not a resident of the state, whatever tangible property that you have in the state that's customarily kept in the state, so for instance, real property would be, I believe that would include real property, would be included in the Minnesota estate. So, and also say if you have a painting or something that's hanging in a gallery in Minnesota for 20 or 30 years, potentially that could be included in the taxable estate.
Mr. Representative Davids.
Mr. Klayman, I'm not a resident of Minnesota anymore. Okay. I moved out of Minnesota, but I still have my master holding the farm and commercial building in Minnesota. I'm not a resident of Minnesota. Minnesota can still nail me on that, but
if I moved all my
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, that's correct. So the residency determination would affect the taxation for estate tax purposes of those intangibles, like the boatloads of money in the bank account and the stocks and the bonds and everything else. Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, that depends on the laws of the other state. So.
Representative Davids, anything further on?
Thank you, Chair. Just hypothetical.
Yes, absolutely. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was actually wondering, kind of on that point also. So like when we have folks who reside in North Dakota, but often those folks own cabins and take advantage of Minnesota being a better place to be. some of those cabins on, like Gull Lake, for an example, like they, those values are well into the millions. The cabins with, three-car garages and four boats and that kind of thing. So I was kind of wondering actually the same thing and how that is affected, but it sounds like they're in North Dakota, so.
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, yeah, just to reiterate, the residency determination for the estate tax affects the intangibles, but if you're a non-resident, those any tangible property that's typically kept in the state could be included in the Minnesota estate for estate tax purposes. So,
thank you. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're back on the estate tax, I guess I was sort of surprised. I mean, obviously, I don't know a ton about any of this stuff, but I was surprised to see both, an exemption for small businesses and farm property, because I think that when we have, discussions about this in public, that's always, the justification that's used of, the reason that we need exemptions from the estate tax is about these, like businesses, family farms that sometimes can have this high value. And so, this other $3 million in exemption, I mean, that's just, for people who have that much cash or that much property laying around? I guess that's the question. Yeah?
Representative Gomez, is that the question?
I don't know. Maybe that's more of a, Ms. Dalton said, yeah, that's the deal. I guess I'll make a statement. I mean,
just got time for questions,
that's fine.
If that would be all right.
That's just a lot of money. All right. I bet nobody in my district gets any benefit from this at all. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like to make sure that we have the facts when we're having these discussions. So I looked up the question about farm estates, and across the whole country, only roughly there are 80 small business and small farm estates nationwide will face any estate tax. So very, very few will hit that $5 million limit. And so I think we have to be realistic that I don't think many people, farmers in Minnesota, because they can take deductions and reduce their liability, will face estate taxes.
I think we're ready for lawful gambling, and that's the next one. The last and final slide. Mr. Klayman, please proceed. Ms. Hagler.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex Hagler, House Research. While Mr. Klayman is trying to get that slide back up, I will just talk briefly about the lawful gambling tax, also known as the charitable gambling tax. It is imposed on two different instances here. You have one flat tax rate of 8.5% that is imposed on paper bingo, raffles, and paddle wheels. And then you have a combined net receipts tax that is imposed on pull tabs, electronic bingo, and tip boards. And the tax is imposed on an organization's net receipts, and that is the gross receipts minus any prizes paid. Thank you. The combined net receipt tax is it has graduated rates based on the net receipts at increments of 9, 18, 27, and 36%. The calendar will run from July 1 to June 30, so this is on a fiscal year.
And each month, the organization calculates its monthly tax liability by adding its net receipts for the year and applying the corresponding rate. The tax paid from the previous month, are subtracted from the current month's taxes, so some organizations will fall into different brackets over the course of the year. And for the 2019 estimate is about $76.8 million.
Research staff, thank you so much for your presentation and for taking questions from members as we went. Members, thank you for your questions and discussion. And the tax committee is where we can have good discussion, as we got into a little bit right here. And that is great and very respectful and appreciate that. Next week, we have tax conformity on Tuesday. We'll have House research staff present that, and then we'll follow up a little bit on Wednesday, but also Wednesday stakeholders, that's a chance to testify. And if you want to testify on tax conformity or just to kind of introduce yourself, please contact Mr. Jessen. Members, if you have someone from your constituency that would like to also testify, you're certainly welcome to do that. So any other comments for the good of the order? If not, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. The tax committee is adjourned.